With This Wind Blowing and This Tide by Morvith, read by CookieMom6067. Chapter 1. Everyone, we're here. This is Niall, Andy announces as she steps through the door. Niall stops in her tracks, staring back at the four people inside the abandoned rectory. Four, not two. And assuming Andy is older than mandatory schooling, she doubts she's older than counting. Three men, one woman, who briefly smiles at her as she passes by and throws her arms around Andy, kissing her. Two of the men, one sitting at the table, curly black hair and dark eyes, black beard, the other standing at the stove cooking, spiky brown hair and light eyes, exchange a glance and roll their eyes. The third man stands, blonde, very tall, reaches across the table and lightly slaps Curly upside his head. Show some respect, you two. Hello, Niall, I'm Sebastian, but you can call me Booker. The lady is Quinn, and these two reprobates are Joe and Nikki. Sorry, the cook says, not sounding sorry at all as he wipes his hands on a rag. Welcome, Niall. I'm Nikki, he offers her his hand. A normal gesture, polite, common, yet it feels alien, out of place, almost as much as waking up after being shot in the head. She can't help but stare at his hand, and there's a band-aid on his pointer finger. I thought our wounds healed. Ah, Nikki pulls back his hand, and she suddenly feels guilty for her rudeness. I thought Andy told you. And you insisted on going, love, Quinn sighs. Andy crosses her arms on her chest. I was too busy dragging her along and dodging patrols. She wasn't exactly happy to come. Sure, blame it on me, Niall grumbles automatically. Joe stands, moves next to Nikki, and wraps an arm around his neck. The collar of his shirt shifts, partially uncovering a hickey on his collarbone. The short version is that Nikki and I are not like the others, though we're still part of the family. It takes her a moment to understand what they mean. You are human. So are you, Nikki says, firm and absolutely certain. And everybody else in this room. Joe nods. It's just that you, Andy, Quinn, and Booker don't stay dead. Niall stares. She doesn't even know where to start. Booker awkwardly clears his throat. You must have questions. Food first, Nikki announces, shrugging off both Joe's arm and his exaggeratedly wounded look, and going back to the pots and pan on the ancient stove. Explanations later. Do you have any allergies, Niall? Food intolerances? No, nothing. Do you want to sit down? Use the bathroom? Quinn asks. You must be tired. Niall is tempted to say she's fine, but she could actually use the bathroom and some privacy. Please tell me you have running water. Quinn laughs, though Niall can't understand what's so funny about her question. Of course, come with me, I'll show you. She does need the toilet, and once she's done, she washes her hands and splashes some water on her face, but after that, she can't quite bring herself to go back out. In between the passing planes, she can hear them through the door chatting, and the sound of plates and cutlery being laid on the table. Nikki humming a song she doesn't recognize as he moves about the kitchen. If she closed her eyes and ignored the voices, the words, just let them become background noise, she could pretend to be home. She hides in there until Quinn knocks and tells her dinner is ready. At the table, they mostly talk about food. Andy compliments Nikki on his cooking, which is apparently nothing new. Nikki throws out menu ideas for the next few days. Joe, Booker, and Quinn offer suggestions or complaints and try to draw her in with little to no success until the conversation runs out into an awkward, tense silence. Niall watches them, and they watch her, like cats circling each other. She puts her fork down, might as well start. So, are you good guys or bad guys? Depends on who you ask, Andy replies as she goes back for seconds. We fight for what we think is right, Quinn adds, taking a sip of water. We do our best. And how do they decide what's right? But that's a big question, too big perhaps. Perhaps it's an unfair one. Besides, there's something else she wants to know just as much. How are you in my dreams? She does not miss the look the other three immortals share. You won't have to worry about that now that you've met all of us, Andromache explains gently. They'll stop. Niall raises her eyebrows. Just like that. They all nod. Exactly. What's the point, then? It's destiny, Nikki offers, setting off groans and eye-rolling from the other immortals. You don't get a vote, Nikki, Andy replies. He simply shrugs. In all seriousness, they do help us find each other, Quinn says. It probably doesn't seem a big deal to you, but it used to take longer, centuries even. Niall stares at her, her mouth dry. Centuries, she repeats blankly. How old are you exactly? I'm the youngest, Booker says, or rather was. I died in 1812, Napoleon's Russian campaign. He adds something in French under his breath. Niall can't quite follow it, but it doesn't sound complimentary. Booker, Joe admonishes him from across the table. Niall's mind is still mildly stuck on the Napoleon thing. She turns to look at Andy and Quinn, trying to guess their age. So you two are older? Quinn grins. Well, I'm only 3,465 years old. I was born at the time of the Hung Kings. I saw the end of the Cone Line and the rise of the Douai. Niall tries to look knowledgeable, but something in her expression must give her away, because Quinn huffs and shakes her head. Never mind. Booker will lend you some books if you're interested. Booker doesn't look at all enthusiastic at the idea. For a moment, he reminds her of her high school librarian who used to treat library books as a dragon treats its hoard. She turns to Andy, not willing to drop the subject. So you're the oldest. Andy sighs. I am. Out of the corner of her eye, Niall sees Joe cross his arms over his chest. Nikki leans back in his chair, waiting. How old are you? Andy glares at her. One does not ask a lady her age. Don't they teach you manners anymore? You're older than manners, Andy, Joe says, grinning. Ah, that's what you think. She glares at him and Nikki both, but they look unconcerned. We had manners, just different ones. You and that other scapegrace there would have got yourselves killed in a second if you'd run across my tribe. Tribe? Niall repeats. Booker takes pity on her. We estimate she's between 6,000 and 7,000 years old, probably closer to 7. Niall doesn't gape, but it's a near thing. She can't stop staring at Andy. Dear God, she looks in her late 30s. Maybe 40s, although if what they say of the good old times that actually weren't all that good, perhaps she died in her 20s. Are we talking the Stone Age? Seriously? Andy sighs and rolls her eyes. I think they call it so now, yes. And before you ask, I did not live in a cave or ride on a dinosaur, she adds, with a glare at Nikki, who rolls his eyes at her while Booker, Joe, and Quinn laugh. I said I was sorry. Many times you can't hold it against me forever. I can and I will. Forever. It's a heavy word. So we really never die, she says softly, almost to herself. But they hear her anyway. Abruptly, the atmosphere changes, all laughter stops. Booker looks down at the table. Quinn and Andromache exchange a single glance, the kind that's worth an entire conversation. Even Nikki and Joe suddenly look nervous, uncomfortable. Nothing that lives can live forever, Booker finally says. What does that mean? Andromache takes a deep breath. There was another like us before Booker. His name was Lycan, Quinn says softly, reverently, staring at her glass without actually seeing it. He was a great warrior, a great friend. Andromache reaches out and wraps an arm around her shoulders, pulling her closer. Quinn leans against her. We traveled together for almost 2,000 years. Then one day his wounds just stopped healing. Quinn closes her eyes. And he died. That's what happens. We don't know when or why. Niall doesn't know what to do with this revelation. Wait, so when you shot me, you could have killed me? Andy shrugs, careful not to dislodge Quinn. I was pretty sure it wouldn't kill you. You're too new. Niall wants to argue, but Quinn suddenly speaks without opening her eyes. There's worse things than dying, child. Andromache goes stiff, though she immediately forces herself to relax again. Booker shudders. Nikki is visibly gritting his teeth, and Joe takes a deep breath and lets it out slowly, puts his elbows on the table and leans his chin on his hands. Andromache whispers something against Quinn's hair in another language Niall doesn't understand, but Quinn replies in English. No, she should know, too. She opens her eyes and her gaze sends shivers down Niall's spine. It happened some 500 years ago in England. Andromache and I were freeing heretics from the witch trials until we were caught and tried for witchcraft ourselves. We were found guilty and sentenced to die. Niall suddenly has a very bad feeling about where this is going. But you didn't. Andy leans back and closes her eyes. We were seen reviving, rather prove their case. She rubs her hand against Quinn's arm. It's my story, Andromache. Quinn. It's hard to describe her voice. She sounds calm, in control, but rather like a frozen river looks calm and still. They put me in an Iron Maiden. Ever heard of them? And then they threw it into the sea, miles away from land. Niall feels her breath catch in her throat. So you were trapped in there, drowning and reviving and drowning again, Quinn says. Joe and Nikki are staring at her as though they wish to hug her and never let go, or invent time travel and break some witch hunters' heads. Booker simply looks sick. They plan to do the same thing to me, I suppose, Andy says tiredly, but I managed to escape before they could. I spent years looking for Quinn, trying to track down every single person who had been on that ship. Is that guilt in her voice? But you found her, I mean. Andy shakes her head. No, I didn't. The chains and locks rusted, and she managed to break out. It took about 10 years, I think, Quinn confirms, then leans back and kisses Andy's cheek, and another 40 to find my poor Andromache again. No dreams, Niall whispers, horrified. Exactly. Quinn forces herself to smile, but it's a fragile, brittle thing. When I was down there, there were times I would have gladly renounced my immortality, though now I'm glad I couldn't. Andromache takes a deep breath and opens her eyes again. I guess we were lucky we didn't have to wait for Booker. Very lucky, Booker grumbles. We probably couldn't have found you if we had looked for 500 years straight. Part of Niall would very much like to be done with the entire evening, thank you. The other part still has questions. She turns to Nikki and Joe. You said you are not immortal. How do you fit in? She makes a vague gesture, unable to find the right words. They're part of the family, Booker immediately says, an edge of warning in his tone. Andy snorts. They are a pain in the ass, that's what they are. Ah, thank you, Andy, Joe laughs and blows her a kiss. Nikki winks at her. You know you love us. Quinn laughs, loud and happy, a startling sound after what she told them. Booker rolls his eyes at them. Sure do. Andy is apparently ignoring them, even as they stare at her, waiting for more. Like I love a bullet to the head. Joe leans toward Niall and says conspiratorially, and that's how you know she does love us. Nikki nods. She uses much worse competitions when we annoy her. Niall frowns, looking between them. There's something slightly strange in the way they all interact. She can't figure out if it's the massive age difference or the immortal mortal thing. How long have you known each other? They exchange a single glance, just like Andy and Quinn did before. It's a long story, Joe shrugs. Perhaps we'd better save it for another day. There's something more there. And though she has already heard more than she honestly wished to, Niall kept bringing herself to let it go. Come on, you can't be much older than me.
I turn 30 in April, Nikki says. Joe will be 33 in July. You still haven't told me what you want to do for your birthday, love.
She doesn't give Joe time to change the subject. Where did they find you in the Foreign Legion? Sometimes they sound like Booker, other times they sound completely different from each other, and she can't pin their accents down. Another speaking look. Booker shifts in his seat.
In the Netherlands, Nikki says eventually. In 93.
For a moment, she thinks she heard wrong. She must have. In 1993, they would have been children. Nikki sighs. He and Joe reach out at the same time and grasp each other's hand, intertwining their fingers without even looking. Next to her, Booker curses softly.
Boys, you don't have to, Quinn says,
but they both shake their heads. Joe takes a deep breath and starts speaking slowly, softly. When we were kids, we were in a bad place. He looks straight into her eyes. If you want bad people, you should have seen those who had us then. Not that there's much left of them, Andy growls. And if Niall still held any doubts about a warrior thousands of years old, her voice right then erases them all. Nikki smiles at her, small and sweet.
We owe Booker, Andy, and Quinn everything. They saved us.
He squeezes Joe's hand.
Though Yusuf saved me first, I wouldn't have survived without him.
Joe, Yusuf, turns to look at him with an expression that can only be described as pure adoration on his face, that should look ridiculous and somehow really, really doesn't.
You saved me too, Ya Amar, never forget that.
And then what? Niall blurts out, they just kept you? Nikki snorts.
It was the other way around, actually. We refused to leave.
Niall looks incredulously at them all. And they what, raised you, trained you? Both Nikki and Joe shrug like it's natural, like it's nothing.
Pretty much, yes, Joe says. We only wanted you to be able to protect yourselves, Booker protests.
He masks it well, but there's some genuine anger in his voice.
In retrospect, we trained them a little too well, Andy grumbles, but it sounds like a cross between an old argument and an inside joke.
Niall's mind is reeling.
It feels like a wheel stuck in the mud, now completely unmoving, now spinning and spinning on itself, unable to find purchase and move on.
She rubs her hands over her eyes and face, her shoulders slump.
I think that's enough for tonight, Booker intervenes. Niall's probably exhausted. She'll want to get some rest.
Good idea. You do the washing up and I'll show her the bedroom, Nikki says, already standing up. From Booker's expression, it's not the result he was going for, but she is too tired to care. They don't have far to go, only in the next room. There's an old iron bed in a corner, an old mattress rolled up in the other, and a couple of camp beds in between.
Not much privacy, I'm afraid, Nikki says apologetically as he gestures to the one on the right.
It's fine, Niall says. Entirely automatically as she drops down on it.
Thank you for showing me and for dinner.
You're welcome.
Sorry about that. It was a lot to spring on you.
No, I asked. She rubs a hand over her face again.
I don't understand you.
And Joe, I guess.
I don't mean to offend you, it's just...
She trails off, unsure on how to phrase it.
You think it's Stockholm syndrome?
His voice sounds perfectly collected, maybe even a bit amused, but she flinches anyway.
Or that it's like a cult.
It's not.
We chose this, both of us.
I guess I can't understand why you would.
Or how you're not scared or envious, since someday we'll die, he shrugs. As Quinn said, there are worse things than dying.
Niall presses her lips together. Was it that easy for you, leaving your family behind? My family is all here.
He sits down on the cot next to hers, leaning his elbows on his knees.
My so-called mother died years ago, but I wouldn't have gone back to her even if I could.
She frowns. What about Joe?
He hasn't got a family beyond us either.
You have to admit that sounds awfully convenient. You called him Yusuf before. Are Joe and Nikki even your real names?
I got the nickname back in school. Now, being Joe raises less eyebrows in Europe and America, especially after 9/11.
Niall startles and turns to the door. Joe is right there, leaning against the old-fashioned frame.
My parents died in a car crash when I was 5.
He sighs and moves to the other cot, Nikki sliding down to leave him some room.
I think we'll have to tell her, Nico.
Not tonight. She has had enough.
She is right here,
Niall says tartly, crossing her arms over her chest.
Just tell me.
Nikki, or Nico, or whatever his name is, hesitates, wets his lips.
It's not a nice story. The beginning, at least.
I wasn't expecting one, Niall replies, raising an eyebrow. I'm a Marine. I can take it.
Yusuf Joe leans against Nikki Nicholas Nico's side, lays a comforting hand on his knee.
Nikki Nicholas Nico wets his lips again.
My mother sold me for drug money when I was 3 years old.
Niall's blood runs cold. Her breath feels frozen in her lungs. She doesn't need to ask what kind of person would buy a child because there's really only one type. Two, maybe. She has heard rumors of illegal adoptions and less than ethical adoption agencies, but she would bet her phone that's not what he's talking about. She watches as Joe gently squeezes his knee and Nikki covers his hand with his own. She can't bring herself to ask. Joe answers her anyway.
I'm a rare case of stranger abduction, though officially I'm listed as a runaway.
Well, I was. I'm a cold case now. Nico here was never even reported missing.
We met in hell, Nikki says, but it got better. Booker came. He, Andy, and Quinn saved us.
Niall has her own opinions on that, on what really saving them would have required, but she's too worn out to argue.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
Don't be, Nikki immediately reassures her.
It was a long time ago.
Being able to tell the true story isn't bad, too. Joe adds. He bumps his shoulder against Nikki's.
Lend me a hand. Quinn and Andy want us to move their mattress in the other room.
Nikki nods and stands.
Sorry, Niall. We'll let you rest now.
Between the two of them, they get the mattress and blankets out, Nikki returning to close the door behind them. Niall lays down on the camp bed.
It's not the best place she has ever slept, but it's not the worst either.
Not for the first time she considers calling her family. Not for the first time her hand hovers over her pocket, fingers playing with the seam and never slipping in. There's just too much she doesn't know.
If they have even been told she's gone, who else might be listening in, waiting for her call?
Nikki said he and Joe don't envy the others, or her by extension. Funnily enough, she thinks she might envy them. Nikki, who needs Band-Aids when he cuts himself, and Joe, whose bruises don't fade in a matter of minutes. Nikki and Joe, who are normal. Of course, if she were like Nikki and Joe, she'd be dead. She'd be on her way back home, all right, inside a coffin. Niall closes her eyes. It's too late, and she's too tired for such heavy, complicated thoughts. In between the noise of the passing planes, other sounds drift in from the other room. Low voices, running water, and the clinks and clangs of the dishes, cutlery, and pots being washed. Somewhere Nikki is humming the same song as before. He's no Frank Ocean, and she still doesn't recognize the song, but she lets it lull her to sleep.
Somebody touches her shoulder and she jolts awake.
Quinn, a Sig Sauer P226 in her hand, and a finger on her lips. Behind her, she sees the other three moving, grabbing weapons.
What?
Andromache heard something. A plane flies overhead, shaking the whole church. Niall looks up, then back at her. Quinn shakes her head and presses the gun into her hands. Just a precaution. Nikki, Joe, your armor, Booker is saying as he sticks one more gun in the back of his pants. Almost done, Joe says. He and Nikki strapping themselves in with quick practice movements. Joe reaches out and gives Nikki's vest a quick tug, more a reassurance than a real check. Booker nods and steps into the other room, glances through one of the boarded up windows as Andy checks out the other. Another plane passes over them. Maybe it's just drunk teenagers, Niall offers. Andromache's shoulders are still tense, her hand clenched around a double-headed axe. Niall, Nikki, Joe, stay back. She starts, walking to the door, Quinn on her right and Booker on her left, and then the door is kicked in. Something hits the ground and Booker shouts, "Grenade!" throwing himself on top of it faster than she thought possible. His whole body shakes with the force of the explosion, like a puppet with the strings cut. Niall dives for covers, or tries to. She feels a bullet hit her back, then another, another. Her bones break, her muscles tear. All around her is darkness, noise, and a storm of bullets. She grits her teeth and returns fire, but all she can see is brief sparkles of light illuminating a scene from hell. Andromache rushing the figures in black, her axe swinging. Joe on the ground, his body twisting in pain as another bullet hits. Quinn, half lying on top of him, frantically trying to bind a tourniquet around his leg and shield him with her body at the same time. Booker blinking back to life, turning his head to look for Nikki and Joe. Nikki half spinning and falling, a large wet patch on his vest. Andromache on the ground, her body riddled with bullets, twitching and jerking and convulsing like a grotesque dance. Just as suddenly as the shooting started, it stops. The sudden silence makes her ears ring. Somebody turns on the lights and Niall blinks quickly, trying to force her eyes to adjust faster. She looks around the room where they spoke and ate only a few hours before in shambles. Men in black. Soldiers. Enemies with submachine guns and assault rifles are all over the room, covering them from every side. There's a cluster on the ground all around Andy, either unmoving or moaning in pain. Niall can't see her. There's four over her, binding her arms and legs, while another two stand guard, ready to shoot at the smallest twitch. Holy shit, look at that. Is it? Fuck, hurry. Niall turns her head. She sees Joe across the room completely still. She can't see his face because Quinn is slumped on top of him and there's two of the bastards moving toward them, so perhaps she will after all. Nikki is lying on his side, still bleeding, the fingers of his right hand twitching as he desperately tries to grab the gun that's just out of his reach. Booker won't take his eyes off him, his voice a broken rattle. Nikki, Nikki, Nikki. Na muerverti. Ti prego, no muerverti, Nikki. What did Andy say on the plane? What's French for play dead? He must speak French, but she can't remember, and it's Nikki. It won't do him any good. 1 minute, two at the most, and he won't have to pretend at all. One of the attackers is walking towards him, and Booker tries to crawl on his arms, on his shredded belly, the pain not even registering. Niall tries to get up too, but her legs won't obey her. There's a bullet stuck between two vertebrae. She can still feel it pushing out, and she can't make it go faster, can't make herself move. There are three men over Booker now, struggling to hold him down. The other man reaches Nikki, kicks the gun away from him, and turns him on his back with his foot. Nikki looks up at him and snarls. His teeth are red. The man just stands over him, unmoving, watching him over his Glock 17. Then he moves back, pulls the trigger, and shoots Nikki in the head. Booker howls. The three men on him go flying. He's on his feet and halfway across the room before they can react. His chest and belly still torn open. Bullets start flying again, hitting him, but he doesn't stop. Not until the bastard who shot Nikki manages to raise his gun and shoot him in the head twice. Niall swears he takes one more step before he falls. Chapter 2. Rotterdam, 1993. Some jobs can be both hateful and extremely satisfying, like this one. Sebastian is more than ready to get to the satisfying part, where Philip Baker gets arrested, or better yet, he gets to pull out a bullet in his head. No, make it his stomach, just so the bastard could die slowly and painfully. The most proper way for him to go, Sebastian daydreams, would be to be crushed, like the spider he is, maybe under one of his containers. Perhaps he will ask Andromache if it can be arranged. It's the least she owes him for this infiltration. The problem is that Philip has very specific tastes, and in order to get close to him, to get him to trust him, Sebastian has had to pretend to share them. Others in the organization tease him for what they call his fastidiousness and his obsession with cleanliness, but some days he feels there's not enough water in the world to make him feel clean. "You've done great, Werner," Philip says, grinning, and amicably slaps his shoulder. What Sebastian wouldn't do to cut that hand off at the wrist. Instead, he ducks his head and rubs his neck. "Thanks, Phil, just doing my best." "Your best is pretty incredible," he's still grinning. "All your hard work deserves a reward. That's why I asked you to come here. I have a special treat for you." Sebastian raises his eyebrows. Philip stands up from the table. "I want to show you my private collection. I'm sure you'll appreciate it." Sebastian forces himself to smile as he follows him to a locked door that opens on a flight of stairs to the cellar. There's another door at the bottom, also locked. Sebastian holds back a sigh and only half listens to Philip's chatter as he fumbles with the keys, mentally steeling himself for pictures or maybe tapes. Hopefully he'll just want to show off how many he has without offering Sebastian a sample. Once the door opens, the cellar beyond looks absolutely ordinary, filled with all the odd bits and ends that don't quite have a place above. Cardboard boxes still packed, old school books, Christmas decorations, an old bike. He expects Philip to head for one of the cardboard boxes. Instead, he locks the door behind him. Sebastian doesn't have to pretend to be startled, but Philip only winks at him. "I must be careful, you'll see." Before he can ask what exactly he's supposed to see, Philip leads him across the room to another door in the corner, half hidden between the shelves. This one has a lock, a padlock, and a deadbolt. It's the deadbolt that sends alarm bells ringing in his head. But before he can quite follow the thought to its logical conclusion, Philip unlocks the door, opens it barely a third of the way, and hurriedly pushes him in before following him and locking up behind him. "Well, what do you think?" he asks, beaming. Sebastian thinks he wishes Andromache were here, or at least her axe. He thinks that he wasn't prepared for this, that nothing in the world could have prepared him for this. His mind vaguely registers some details. The corner with the toilet and a dripping tap over a plastic tub, ratty towels, a pile of folded clothes, the bottles of water, the bare light bulb that was already on. But all he can really see is a single bed and the two children. Two little boys, sitting on it side by side, holding hands so tightly, their small, short nails are digging into their skin. The oldest has a mop of dark curls, olive skin, even though they clearly haven't seen the sun in a long time. 6 or 7 years old, no more. Perhaps North African or Middle Eastern origins. The younger looks too thin. Scrawny. He's under 5 years old, Sebastian would bet his first edition Don Quixote. Philip is still talking about what a prize they are. Not quite tame yet, and he must be careful. There will be rules. Sebastian hears him but doesn't listen. In one step, he's in front of the bed, in front of them, crouching down to their height. He spent his whole life, immortal and not, mostly trying to make himself look smaller than he actually is, non-threatening. and never before he has so fervently hoped to succeed. Brown eyes and gray eyes converge on him, scrutinize him flat and hard, but not empty, not dead. He feels a tiny, fragile flicker of hope push through the horror. "Hello," he says softly. No answer. Not that he was expecting one. What he was expecting, what he was watching for, is the flicker of understanding, the lightning quick glances between them. So they speak Dutch. Good.
"What are your names? Can you tell me your names?"
The language is all wrong, but his voice, it's the same voice he used when his own children were small and scared. Silence again, but only for a moment, because the younger boy suddenly replies in a low, scratchy voice, even as the older one frantically squeezes his hand.
"Niccolo."
The older boy can't quite hold back a frustrated sigh that turns into a cough.
"Yusuf."
"Niccolo and Yusuf, thank you. Are you going to be good for me?"
He hates saying it. He knows they must have heard that sentence before and what it means for them, but he needs them to obey, because there's really only one way this will end. Yusuf's shoulders stiffen. He immediately pulls Niccolo closer, but Niccolo keeps staring at him without blinking, like he's looking straight into his soul.
"Yes," he says.
Yusuf glares at him but nods.
"I want you to close your eyes and cover your ears. Can you do that?"
They have no reason to listen to him, no reason to trust him, but miraculously they do. Niccolo first, Yusuf maybe half a second after him. He's on his feet and moving before Philip sees them, before he realizes he's coming. Sebastian is big. He may deliberately try to look smaller, slower, but he has always been fast, and he's even faster now. After a century and a half under Andromache and Quinn's tutelage, his fist catches him in the face, slams him back against the wall. Then Sebastian is on him, hitting him with all his strength. That's where he fucks up. Instead of making it quick, he loses himself in his fury and keeps punching him over and over again until Philip manages to pull a switchblade from his pocket and stabs him in the neck. It's the last thing he does. Sebastian breaks his neck as soon as he feels a blade cut through his skin, but the damage is done. He staggers backwards, trying to hold on to the wall with one hand and stem the flow of blood with the other, but all he manages to do is fall sideways, his vision already going gray around the edges. The last thing he sees before he dies is Yusuf protectively curled around Niccolo, his hands covering Niccolo's over his ears. His eyes are wide open, staring at him. That was the beginning. But there was more. So much more. Chapter 3. They kill all the guards in the van. Rather, Quinn does, and he assists when she needs it. If she needs it. It won't bring the boys back. It doesn't erase the haunted, terrified look from her eyes, either, the kind of look that slices right through him, all the way to his heart. His wounds healed, but he still feels torn open, raw. He wants to tell her to get out and leave him here, let him get to the bottom of this, but his voice won't work. His tongue feels heavy in his mouth, like a stone. The van rolls to a stop before he can find the words, before they can free themselves properly. Any hope they had that Andromache would free herself and Niall is dashed almost immediately. The bodies that tumble out of the second van look worse than theirs, more broken, bloodier. Andromache the Scythian has forgotten more ways to kill than entire armies will ever learn. She doesn't have to make it this bloody unless she wants to. Quinn teasing her about mellowing out in her old age, Andy flipping her off in response, Joe's soft laugh, and Nikki's quiet snort. And she must have wanted to. She's still incandescent with rage when they drag her out, she and Quinn both burning like stars, like forest fires. Sebastian understands it in a distant, muted way. At some point, he too will reach murderous rage, but not yet. Not yet. Two men in civilian clothes stare at them in disbelief.
Get him on the plane now,
one of them shouts, aiming a Glock 17 at them, and the guards hurry to obey him. He's wearing a dark jacket, not the black uniform of the field operatives. He didn't shoot Joe and Nikki, but he sent the men who did. Even buried deep under the fog of grief, Sebastian will remember his face. The other man in a light-colored jacket frowns. Where are the other two?
Dead.
They were nothing special. You said so yourself. The second man recoils.
That wasn't what we agreed on.
Quinn spits at them, curses them in Vietnamese. Real curses, not just calling them names. It's a pity they can't appreciate it. The man in the light jacket looks and sounds somewhat familiar, but right now Sebastian is more interested in their next ride, a private plane with Merrick painted in white square letters on the black background above a light blue band. He knows that name, that logo. Nikki's showing him an article on his phone about a new treatment for cancer, smiling.
Some days there are good news, too.
Andromache plants her feet on the ground and refuses to be moved, staring at the man in the light jacket. Copley.
He knows that name, too. CIA agent. Quit when his wife got ill. Working as a freelancer now. They looked into him after spending 7 months dodging his calls. Nikki and Joe had offered to meet him, be their shield, but he, Andromache, and Quinn vetoed it. Copley stopped trying around February. There's something there. A connection his brain is desperately trying to make, but he can't, not now. Because Nikki will never smile again. And Yusuf will never laugh again.
His sketch of Niall's face will never be finished. And hey, Sokoli, I can't help it. It's stuck in my head.
Yes, Habibi, but do you have to get it stuck in ours, too?
Is the last song Nikki ever sang.
He'll never hear their voices again or walk in on them kissing or see them reach out and grasp each other's hand. Their loss, the full reality of it, hit him all at once. And it feels like being caught in a landslide. Like having a whole building collapse on top of him. His knees buckle under the weight, but he forces himself to remain upright. He will not give them the satisfaction of his pain, his heartbreak. He lets them push him up the ladder and down into a seat. Private planes aren't really meant to transport prisoners, but they try to keep them as far apart as possible. Niall ends up somewhere behind him. Andromache and Quinn try to catch his eye, but he ignores them. They don't need him. They've never needed him.
Look at them. They need us. What am I supposed to do? Leave them by the side of the road and hope for the best?
He'll fall in with whatever they decide, but not now. Not now. Now all he can do is sink into his memories. All his memories. From the beginning. From the moment he opened his eyes again on the concrete floor of that cellar. 26 years worth of memories. He never expected to have so many. It was supposed to be temporary, first until they got better. A scene without words. Waking up in the night to make sure the boys were still breathing and finding Andromache or Quinn bending over their bed, one hand checking Yusuf's forehead or Nikki's, and eyes fixed on the rise and fall of the blankets. Then, until they found their relatives, well, decent relatives, but Niccolo's nonna was dead. The woman who birthed him was only fit to be hanged. And believe me, Quinn, I, of all people, do not say that lightly. Yusuf's grandparents were either dead or too frail. His uncle had quarreled with his father, and when Andromache and Quinn hinted at what Yusuf had been through, well, the surviving Mr. Alkazani had not been an option. Social services had been considered. They didn't look like the orphanages and poor houses he remembered, but how could they trust them when they had lost Yusuf in the first place? When they hadn't even realized he had been kidnapped, and really, did they think a 6-year-old boy who spoke primarily Arabic could just vanish into thin air on his own? They hadn't reckoned with the boys themselves, too.
Nico must stay with me.
What, Yusuf?
Why can't we stay with you? Why? You can't die.
You won't leave us.
I don't want to go. I'm scared.
Why can't we stay?
It hadn't been easy, none of it, starting from the decision itself. He remembers sitting around the kitchen table in the safe house near Köln, all avoiding each other's eyes, talking softly in Vietnamese as Yusuf and Nicola slept, only nominally in separate beds, since they always found them together in the morning.
Are we doing this?
Are we really doing this?
We must all agree.
Once we start, we can't go back. It must be until they are of age, until they can take care of themselves, 14 years at least. Can we do it? Can we risk it?
They might hate us in the end.
One day we will lose them and it will hurt even worse than now. Can we do it? The boys' insistence on staying together had struck a chord with Andy and Quinn, but it was his vote that carried the day. He had been of two minds the whole time. How could they take care of children? How could they set themselves up for heartbreak again? Was he betraying his own sons, his real family? In the end, though, he couldn't bring himself to leave them. Not when he saw them back in that damp cellar every time he closed his eyes. Yes, he knew it was statistically unlikely to happen. But logic did absolutely nothing to soothe his fears. Perhaps it had been madness, after all. Going back into the world, deciding where to live, how to raise them, dealing with doctors and schools and churches and mosques during the boys' religious phase. Even establishing identities had been a headache and a half. Yusuf didn't want to change his name, and they hadn't wanted to erase his grief, so he ended up under Andromache's guardianship, or rather, Anne Marie Martin's. On paper, she was a family friend who had taken him in after his parents died in a car crash. The best lies must always hold a grain of truth. Nicolo didn't know his own surname. Officially, he bore his mother's, but they privately agreed all ties to that woman were better severed and forgotten, and they had ended up calling him Djenova after the city of his birth. He could have been Sebastian Djenova, too, but he refused to be his father on paper, even if it complicated things. In the end, Nicola became his nephew, the son of his entirely fictional sister, Christine Dubois, who had recently remarried and whose new husband did not care for his stepson. He had been Jean-Sebastian Dubois, technical manuals writer with a passion for history and literature. The boys had grown up between the south of France, Italy, and Tunisia, with frequent camping trips in Europe, North Africa, and even Asia. They spoke French, Italian, and Arabic like native speakers, switching between languages and mixing them in what became their own personal dialect. What little Dutch they had, they forgot. He got so much from those years. Some memories are happy. Yusuf and Nicolo kicking around a ball in the playground, smiling. Yusuf and Nicolo chasing each other, climbing trees, swimming, laughing. Yusuf peeking into the bedroom next door.
Tante Andy! Tante Quinn, I had a nightmare. Can we sleep in your bed?
Can we have hot chocolate for breakfast? Can we, please?
Toy shops. Just toy shops. It was hard to say who found them more exciting, the boys or their guardians. A recovered photograph, baby Yusuf with his parents. The look on Yusuf's face when they gave it to him. Yusuf and Nicolo curled up against him on the sofa, asleep halfway through the movie, Quinn laughing quietly. Joe shaking his head, grinning as Nicky lost a bet.
I don't know why it bothers. We'll never win anything. We both used up our lifetime's allotment of luck the day you found us.
We were the lucky ones, kid.
The Let's Find Something That Scares Andy prank campaign, 1996 to 2002, unsuccessful. Joe and Nicky buying baby wipes in bulk, slipping fresh packages into their kits and carrying one extra in their own in case he or Andy or Quinn had to clean suspicious amounts of blood off of themselves in a hurry. Always the unscented brand Andy preferred.
I know you said no photos, so I drew you. Do you like it?
Booker, Andy, Quinn, look!
Settle down, you two, or no story.
No! Please, Uncle Booker.
All right, get in bed, both of you. We're starting a new book tonight. Are you ready?
Can we have one of your stories, too, please?
Maybe later, if you're still awake. Now let's begin. Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Chapter 1, in which Phileas Fogg and Passepartout. They were still awake later, and he ended up caving about the story. The first time they don't flinch or go unnaturally still when he goes near them. The first time Niccolo hugs him, throwing his arms around his waist and squeezing tightly. The first time Yusuf hugs him, quick and hard, and accidentally headbutts him in the stomach. Other memories aren't as happy, but are treasured in retrospect because it's over. Arguments to get them into the bathtub. Arguments to get them out of the bathtub. Yusuf submitting stoically to having his hair dried. Niccolo running all around the room, a blessing on whoever invented extension cords. Midnight pharmacy runs, Andromache quietly panicking over cough syrups. Quinn's opinions on children's clothes. Pink is for girls, since when? That's not a lullaby, Andy. That's a Russian war song. Ugh, fine. Our apprentice Tom may now refuse to wipe his scoundrel master's shoes, for now he's free to sing and play over the hills and far away. Andromache! Days, years spent training them, practicing punches and kicks over and over, showing them where to hit in order to bring down a grown man, how to run and hide and evade pursuit, what to do if their opponent had a weapon, and how to use it if they got it away from them. Joe and Nikki soaking it all up like little sponges, always coming back for more. Andromache, they won't heal if they break their neck.
I know what I'm doing, Booker. They won't learn any younger.
You want to put them on a wild animal that weighs half a ton, bites on one end, kicks on the other, and I shouldn't worry.
Madame Martin, Monsieur Dubois, we have called you here because your children have taught their classmates a most unsuitable version of Saira.
Some memories will only ever be sad.
Yusuf, look, the sun.
Niccolo whispers excitedly, and Yusuf struggles to open his eyes.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's only a pallid wintry sun barely struggling through the clouds, and the boys are still too ill to get out of bed, never mind go outside and enjoy it. Yet they stare at the window in awe until exhaustion claims them again. They don't notice the look on Quinn's face or that she practically runs out of the room. Niccolo's tiny fist beating against his leg.
Where's Yusuf? What did you do to him?
Then the bathroom door opening and Yusuf rushing out.
Nico, I'm here. I'm sorry. I was hungry. I'm sorry, Nico.
The younger boy throwing his arms around him is sobbing.
You left. You weren't there.
Yusuf's purple face as he shouts, struggling against Andy's embrace.
You are liars. All grown-ups are liars. You want to leave us. You'll go away and never come back, like Mama and Baba.
A tear falls, then another and another, until they are a torrent, a rainstorm, and every sob shakes his body like thunder. Andy pulls him close and lets him cry, whispering gently, "We are here, little one. We will never leave you, I promise." Quinn, kneeling down next to them, rubbing soothing circles on his thin shoulder. Death can't keep us, and the ocean itself couldn't part me from my Andromache. What force on earth could stand between us and our boys? The boys, standing in front of the washing machine at 2 a.m. with a pile of sheets and blankets, both defiantly proclaiming to have been the one who wet the bed and who should be punished, even if Yusuf's pajama pants were dry and Nicolo's were not.
I miss my mama and baba.
The one photograph of Nicolo from before they confined was taken at the parish church Easter picnic. He and his nonna are off to the side. Nicolo's face all blurry and out of focus because he turned around just at the wrong moment. He goes and looks at it sometimes, stares at his nonna's face.
I don't really remember her anymore. If you are ever captured, we'll come for you, I promise you. We'll do whatever it takes to get you back, however, it might take time. And you might not have it.
Quinn takes a deep breath.
You'll have to judge for yourselves. I want you to remember this always. Hold on for as long as you can, but if it gets too much, remember, you have a way out.
16 years later, and they have the same hard look in their eyes.
We promise. There are worse things than dying,
Joe whispers, his hand clasped around Nikki's. Some memories will only ever be bitter.
Monsieur Dubois, Nicolas punched Julien in the face. He called Joe a dirty towelhead.
Okay, one, his name is Nicolo, and two, that was well done.
Monsieur Dubois!
Weren't you supposed to go watch the new Lord of the Rings film with your friends?
They're not my friends.
What happened? Did you have a fight?
Yusuf?
They said they don't want me to bring Nikki. If he can't go, I'm not going either.
Yusuf, Nikki is 13. Perhaps you should...
No, I won't. Nikki's worth 10 of them anyway.
He's a bright boy. He could do so much better if he only applied himself.
Over and over again from their teachers, which never made any sense, because the boys were bright, and they did love learning. They were always asking them questions and to show them things. And of course, the worst ones until now, the memories he hates, the ones he never thinks about if he can help it. The first time he walks in on Nikki and Joe, kissing, right there in the middle of the kitchen. Joe with his left arm around Nikki's waist and his right hand buried in his hair, Nikki's arms around his neck. A lover's kiss. A lover's embrace. Comfortable and unhurried and familiar.
Quarter of an hour later, the boys sitting at the same table holding hands. Yusuf is the love of my life.
And Nicolo is the love of mine.
No, he's more than that. He's,
you are 17.
And you're 20. You are children.
What do you know about love? You barely lived at all. You,
what? Should we wait until we're your age? Your real age?
Just because we won't live as long as you.
Quinn's chair scraping against the tiles. Excuse us, boys. We're taking Booker outside to get some air before you three say something you'll regret. Andromache's iron grip on his arm, the door slamming shut behind them, his mind full of the Westermark effect and codependency, Nikki and Joe dropping therapy a few months before, and the way they never asked to spend the summer with their friends, only for more training.
That can't be right. We must have fucked up somewhere. They weren't supposed to.
Booker, are you seriously telling me you didn't see it coming?
Because you did?
Wait, you did?
How?
When?
Nikki has been in love with Joe since he was 15. Joe, it's actually hard to say. Being the eldest, he worried. I think it was around the same time, too. But he wouldn't let himself look too closely. As for how, well, the usual way, I guess.
He still remembers the entire fight, when Quinn and Andy demolished all his arguments and mercilessly uncovered the real source of his unease.
I know you want to give them everything you couldn't give your sons, a normal life, an education, a wife, a family, but Booker, they don't want it.
Isn't it enough that they're happy?
Of course it is. It's just, they're too young.
Remind me again. How old were you when you married Suzanne?
I was 20, but that was different. Because you married in August and your daughter was born in December, we know. Good news. Nikki's not pregnant, and neither is Joe.
Andromache laughs so hard she cries.
He apologized to them, but things were awkward for a while. The next April, Nikki turned 18. He was preparing himself to say goodbye, waiting for the moment their immortality would no longer be a wonder but a curse, a source of fear and anger. Instead, Nikki and Joe started their "We Want to Join You" campaign. Joe and Nikki sitting side by side on the sofa, their shoulders bumping together.
"We can help. You trained us. You know we can. We can be your shield. Make sure nobody notices your gift. Our place is with you. It has always been."
At least this time, Andromache and Quinn were on his side, though the boys had been relentless. Napoleon could have learned a thing or two from them. Again, he had been the lone holdout. Perhaps if he hadn't reacted so badly when he found out about them, if he hadn't still felt guilty over it, he would have managed to hold out longer. Perhaps he wouldn't have given in at all. But he had. He, Andromache, and Quinn agreed to bring them along on some missions. Nothing too dangerous, just enough to give them a taste of what their lives were really like, to knock some of the idealism out of them. A warning from Andromache. "Don't think you'll change the world."
"Why not? You changed ours."
Nikki, devastatingly.
"You gave us the world."
Joe, quietly. A total spectacular failure. It hadn't worked at all. Training them harder, trying to set them up in other roles with humanitarian organizations, none of it worked. He'd even been tempted to try and go off the grid, disappear. But Andromache and Quinn would have never agreed, and he couldn't do it to his boys. He couldn't let them come home to an empty house and a letter of excuses. He had to admit, too, that the boys were never reckless, never hasty or irresponsible. Even with three immortals ready to put themselves between them and any danger, they had never taken them or their ability for granted. The same care and consideration they had for each other, they extended to the whole team as easily as breathing. They were always ready to run interference or distract potential witnesses. "Face it, you're stuck with us."
"Hey, it's not like it's forever."
Silence, and he can only imagine the look on his own face if he looks half as devastated as Andy's or Quinn's.
"I shouldn't have said that, sorry, but it's true. Let's not waste the time we have."
In the back of his mind, he always knew. He found them together. He would lose them, together. Not like this, though. It was never supposed to end like this. They were supposed to walk away, or, failing that, pass in their sleep in their 90s, surrounded by adopted children and grandchildren.
"You've seen them, Booker. They'll do it with or without us, and at this point it's better with us. We'll protect them. We'll see them to the other side."
He never confessed it to anyone. But for all his protests, part of him had also been happy, relieved. It was only supposed to be 14 years. They got almost twice as much. 14 years, 26 years. What are they to centuries? Millennia. All. They were all. And more. He should have known better. No, he should have been better. He failed them. Again. Worse than Jacques Henri and Jean-Pierre, perhaps. All his children from his first life had funerals, Christian burials. At the time, it had not been a comfort. Even the services for those who died before he did the first time, when he had no reason to think he wouldn't join them one day. He hadn't realized then that there were worse things. There are always worse things. What will they do to Joe and Nikki? Will they burn them? Will they leave them there to rot? At least move them down to the crypt? But they won't lay them down together the way they should be, embracing for all eternity like the lovers of Valdaro, of Aleppo Tripa. The thought won't leave him alone. It torments him through the landing and another journey in a van to one of those tall buildings, all glass and steel, Andromache can't stand. They are brought up to some sort of office before some long-faced infant who greets them unctuously and introduces himself as Stephen Merrick, the backer of the whole operation, presumably, with a neat little speech prepared.
He isn't really listening, but two things catch his attention anyway. The first is the mention of a video Copley showed him. They didn't really need Merrick to tell them that Copley found them out, sold them out. But now the final piece clicks into place, and he knows exactly when, where, and how.
It's Friday, and South Africa is the drunk driving capital of the world. What are you looking at, Nikki?
I thought I saw something moving. Probably just a bird.
The second is a word, a single word. Prophet. And suddenly he's angry. Furious. He's never been so angry in his whole life. That's why Nikki and Joe died? For fucking profit. Not just money. Money could have understood. He could have accepted that eventually. Profit. For the shareholders and Mr. Youngest CEO in pharma, a man who isn't worth the mud on Joe and Nikki's boots.
Vous avez tué mes fils.
The words are out in the open, spoken before he even finishes thinking them.
All he gets are blank looks of incomprehension, tinged with petulant annoyance in Merrick's case. Of course, Les Gourdons would not understand.
He raises his head, looks straight at them. Merrick steps backward, almost stumbles in his haste.
You killed my sons,
he repeats slowly. In English, so they'll understand. Copley, trying to hide on the side, flinches. He flinches, the bastard, like he cares, like he didn't mean to have his boy's blood on his hands. And what exactly did he think would happen? He doesn't tell them they're all dead. He doesn't shout, doesn't curse them, doesn't utter a single threat, just watches them. Merrick tries to recover, talks about helping every human being on Earth and moral obligation. If Joe were here, he'd laugh at him for comparing them to mice. If Nikki were here, he'd tell them to go read a history book and a few on ethics while they're at it. Nikki and Joe are not here. Nikki and Joe are nowhere now, only in his memories. And Andromache's and Quinn's, too. He knows they love them. He knows they're suffering, too, but his own pain is too heavy. He cannot carry theirs. There's nothing left of them save two cold bodies, if even that, and 26 years' worth of photographs. He keeps his eyes open through the cracking tasers, through the injection, staring. Copley. Merrick. Keen. They're only the first on the list. He doesn't know in what order he'll get them or how, but he will get them. All of them. To be a great forger, mes poulets, one must be patient and thorough, have an eye for details. Working quickly is important, too, but the real master must work quickly and well, and it cannot be done without first having learned patiently and thoroughly. Ah, ça ira, ça ira, ça ira, les aristocrates à la lanterne. Ah, ça ira, ça ira, ça ira, les aristocrates on les pendra. Si on ne les prend pas, on les rompra. Si on ne les prend pas, on les brûlera. Ah, ça ira, ça ira, ça ira. The beloved voices fade. Both the older ones and the new, and he wakes up strapped to an examination table hooked to monitors, unsurprisingly. The blonde doctor keeps working. Somewhere beyond, he catches bits and pieces of a conversation between Merrick and Copley. He turns away. Quinn, Andromache, and Niall are on his left, strapped to tables of their own, still and unmoving. The doctor is busy with him, so she misses the moment Quinn and Andromache wake, though she probably would have missed it anyway. After the witch trials, they became very, very good at playing dead. Niall doesn't move. Poor girl, what an introduction to her new life.
"Do you feel the wound trying to close?" asks the doctor.
Kozak, according to her badge, hello, name number 4. Although he'll gladly leave her to Andromache and Quinn, Niall might want a piece of her, too. He doesn't answer her, lets his eyes wander over the impressive arrays of samples she has already collected.
Huh. Remarkable.
It's all he can do not to laugh in her face.
So that's what you are after. Immortality.
Dr. Kozak doesn't seem surprised by his question.
Is this where you tried to warn me off? Tell me I should not meddle in things a mere mortal can't understand.
He turns his head, looks up at her.
Au contraire. I wish you every success. I hope you'll get the secret of our immortality to your boss and get to use it yourself.
She blinks but quickly recovers her composure. When she speaks again, she sounds vaguely amused.
So I can live long enough to regret it.
He smiles.
So I can spend the rest of my life killing you over and over again. Once wouldn't be enough.
She flinches back. All traces of amusement vanish from her face. Then she turns away from them, ostensibly to secure the last batch of samples. There's still a certain hurry in her movements when she steps outside, probably telling herself she is not scared. Quinn opens her eyes, breathing in through her nose and out of her mouth. Andromache raises her head to check on them both, then Niall wakes up thrashing.
Niall, stop, you're hurting yourself.
Booker, help Quinn. Niall, look at me, breathe like I do. He immediately switches to Vietnamese, reassuring his older sister that she's not alone. Right now it's just them. He and Andromache are here with her. He asks if he can start counting to 10 and gets a tiny nod in response. At 5, Quinn's breathing evens out. At 8, she opens her eyes and smiles tremulously at him.
I'm here, Booker.
He smiles back. On the other side of her, Niall has stopped struggling. She just lies there staring at Andromache, her eyes shining with unshed tears.
I promise you, Niall. Whatever it takes, you won't spend the rest of your life here.
She nods slowly.
Wish we had gotten super strength along with super healing.
Oh, that would have been nice, Quinn sighs, feeling herself enough she can manage English for her new sister's sake.
We'll manage, Andromache says. Booker better stop warning them, though.
Sorry, boss.
No, you're not.
But I can't blame you. Her voice is unbearably soft. It still hurts, acknowledging it out loud for the first time. It hurts so much, he almost lashes out at her, but his rage ebbs instead of rising again. It's not that she didn't love them as much as he did. It's just that Andromache had had to live alone among mortals for longer than all of them have been alive, even including Lycan. This is not the first time she loses her family, or the second. It doesn't make her current grief any less real, any less deep. But she knows how to keep herself moving in spite of it, how to grit her teeth and go on. He hasn't learned yet. He isn't sure he ever will, no matter how long he lives. Case in point.
I mean it, though. Stop. I was about to headbutt Merrick before you scared him away.
Now I am truly sorry. Niall manages a tired chuckle.
I wish you had.
We can use it, though, Quinn says, switching to Vietnamese again. Get them to focus on Booker.
And underestimate us? Andromache finishes in English, again for Niall's benefit. It could work.
Niall frowns. Hate to rain on your parade, but there's no underestimating you, Andy. I do vote against waiting until they become immortal. Quinn sounds almost regretful.
Me too. Sorry, Booker.
Do I get a vote? Niles asks, because I'm with Quinn.
Noted, he says. Unnecessary, though. I don't expect they will, even if they worked at it for 1,000 years.
He can't help the mournful sigh that escapes him. A pity, really. I have so many ideas, I can hardly pick one.
You're not the only one, Booker, Andromache says, her voice a low growl. But once will have to be enough.
He nods. I know.
The doctor comes back, and all conversation ceases.
It's a long day. He and Andromache manage to keep Quinn from 2 other panic attacks, and the 3 of them try to distract Niall when Kozak starts working on her. They get breaks whenever Kozak needs one herself. The first time she leaves, Niall tentatively offers her condolences for Joe and Nikki.
They were good people, she whispers carefully, as though afraid to step on a mine.
They were, he chokes out through the unbearable lump in his throat, the best.
He should tell her that they had been so happy to meet her, so worried about her, that there's so much she'll miss out.
Merrick and Copley stole from her, too, but words fail him again. Instead, he talks about all the deaths he would have Merrick, Copley, Keene, and Dr. Kozak try for themselves if they were immortal. His first idea is hanging them the old-fashioned way. Aside from Keene, who has muscles on his side, they don't look particularly heavy, so it should take a while. He could leave them there for days like it was for him.
What, no freezing to death? Andromache asks. After all the moaning and groaning we get about the cold.
Joe, where's your jacket?
Go put an undershirt on, Nikki.
Ah, Uncle, it's 25 degrees outside. It's not even windy.
Too difficult to arrange. What would you recommend, Andromache, setting them on fire?
Oh, absolutely.
Throw them into the sea, Quinn unexpectedly offers with a smile that's all teeth. But make their coffin out of concrete.
He nods. Remember the U-boat base in San Nazaire? We'll use so much concrete it will look like a sandcastle.
After a while, Niall offers a couple of suggestions, too. They count it as a win, though it doesn't last for long.
It's a long, long day.
Eventually, as all things must do, it ends. Kozak leaves, presumably to have dinner and report to Merrick. Quinn starts a round of bets on the exact order.
He doesn't take it.
Booker? Booker, talk to me, Andromache whispers.
He should.
They should know. And he doesn't know what will happen next, if they'll be kept here or separated.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
What are you talking about?
He can feel Quinn's eyes, so he can't bring himself to turn his head and meet them. He keeps staring at the ceiling as it grows more blurred.
This, Joe and Nikki, it's all my fault.
What do you mean? Niall's voice unexpected with a hard edge and, oh fuck, she doesn't know. He'll have to explain everything.
Remember the video Merrick mentioned?
I think it was me.
Copley tried calling us for months. He stopped in February.
In March, Nikki, Joe, and I were in Port Elizabeth. There was an accident.
What accident? Andromache asks, her voice as sharp as her axe.
I was run over by a car.
He stops, swallows hard, but there's still a lump in his throat.
We thought it was just an accident. It's South Africa, the fucking drunk-driving capital of the world,
Joe told him as he recovered, trying to cheer him up.
Nikki looking up towards the roof in the dark sky. Most people forget to look up, but not Nikki. Not their sniper.
The boys brought me into an alley. But there must have been a drone.
Andromache sits up, as much as her restraints allow.
Why didn't we know? Why didn't you tell us?
We thought it was just an accident. Bad luck. You hadn't joined us yet. You were on honeymoon.
His voice stumbles on the last word, another one of Joe and Nikki's little jokes. And there are too many to list. Too many to count. They'll keep stumbling on them for years, maybe centuries. It's both awe-inspiring and frightening how completely they filled every aspect of their lives in such a short time. They were ivy and mint, growing unchecked in every corner of their hearts, sinking their roots wide and deep. This time, it doesn't feel like a landslide or a collapsing building. This time, it's a rising tide, a flooding river that fills him and fills him until there's nothing else left. He is tired, too tired to keep fighting it. He closes his eyes, tears spilling slowly down his cheeks.
You were right. You were always right. I should have let them go. They'd still be alive if I had let them go.
There's a soft thud as Andromache drops back against the table.
It's not all on you, Booker.
She sounds tired, like she can feel every single one of her 6,000 years.
Remember what I said? They're not like us. They can't do it forever. How much time can they have? 15, 20 years. We can keep them safe for 20 years. I was so stupid, so arrogant, and they paid the price.
Niall clears her throat.
For what it's worth, Nikki told me they chose this.
I don't think they regretted it. There's nothing he can say to that. Maybe someday he'll believe it. Maybe someday it will be a consolation. But not now. Not now. For a while, none of them speak. Quinn, Andromache, and Niall trade ideas and observations about the building and the security team, though it's too early to detect patterns. He manages a couple of contributions of his own. The doctor returns, so she ignores them for her computer. About 5 minutes later, the door opens again, and two of Keane's men step in. Dr. Kozak frowns and stands, briskly moving around her desk.
What are you doing here? I haven't requested.
Whatever it is that she hadn't requested, they'll never know. Because her words abruptly end in a rattle, then a sharp crack. He raises his head just in time to see her drop, one of the security guys grabbing her and dragging her behind her desk while the other stands by the door. Then the first guard turns and... There's a sharp intake of breath on his left. Niall swears softly.
Booker blinks once, twice, but it can't be real. It's impossible. They are dead. He saw them die. He's only dreaming of Nikki and Joe, of his boys. He doesn't remember being drugged, but perhaps he was. Perhaps it's his time. And this is not a bad way to go, though he would have liked to dream of his other children, too. Marie and Jacques and Marie-Jean and Henri and Jean-Pierre.
Such a beautiful dream. He's not sure why they don't look like the last time he saw them, why his mind conjures them with shorter hair and a shorter beard in Eustace's case, but apart from that, every last detail is perfect. Their faces, the way they stand, the way they move. Simply perfect. One by one, the chains that hold his family fall away. Niall whispers her thanks, her eyes shining with amazement and a smile blooming on her lips. Andy rises with tears in her eyes, cupping Nikki's face between her hands and pressing a kiss to his forehead. Quinn's wild, joyous laugh as she throws herself at him, hugging him with such force he has to take a step backwards. He even pulls her daggers out from under the security guard vest as Andy gets a gun from Joe and jokingly complains about favoritism because they didn't bring her axe. But why wouldn't he dream her her axe? No matter. Nikki is turning to him, moving closer. He should tell him not to come. He's not ready for this lovely dream to be over. He should tell him. He loves them both, at least here. But he loses himself in watching them. The belts and restraints are undone. Nikki leans over him, frowning, worried. Any moment now.
Booker?
Nikki says and puts a hand on his shoulder.
Papa?
He can feel his hand. It's warm, heavy, solid. He knows that hand,
How could he not, when he saw it grow into its current size, saw it acquire every callus and every scar? He knows the width of its palm and the length of every finger. Nikki's hand doesn't disappear, doesn't fade, not even when he brings up one of his own trembling hands and touches it. It's still there. He's still there. And Joe hands his submachine gun to Niall and comes to stand next to Nikki, grabs his shoulder. Booker, are you okay? Booker sits up so fast their heads almost collide, his movements momentarily dislodging Nikki's hand before he reaches out and grabs it again, his left hand reaching out for Joe. They're still warm, still solid, arms and shoulders and cheeks under his hands. It's you, Booker whispers. It's really you. How? Nikki smiles. I told you it was destiny. Don't be too smug about it, Hayati, Joe says, but he is grinning too. Booker laughs, his eyes swimming with tears, and pulls them both into a hug. His boys, his sons, not by blood, but they are still the children of his heart, and they are here, in his arms, alive and breathing, and, dare he think it, immortal. It seems impossible, unbelievable, a miracle. Three guards burst through the door, and Niall dispatches them quickly before turning back to them. Hate to interrupt the family reunion, but we have to go now. Just a moment. Nikki turns and starts smashing freezers and every single sample Kozak took from them. Joe moves to her computer, quickly looking through her last activities and deleting as he goes. She had more than that. I've got the location. It's not far. We must stop Merrick, or he'll never stop coming after us. Andy says. We could split, Joe says. Andromache makes a face, then nods. All right. Andy. She rolls her eyes at him, the hypocrite. You can go with them, Booker, but we're all walking out of here together. Got it? There's a disjointed chorus of yes, Andy, and yes, boss. Andromache looks at them, at their family, and smiles. All right. Let's get that motherfucker. The end.